Into every episode of Ridiculous History, a little rain must fall. Hi, I'm Ben.
I'm Noel. That was nice, Ben.
Thanks, man.
I like it. Changing it up a little bit for the opening.
Mm-hmm. And we are joined, as always, with our super producer, Casey Pegram.
He's on the ones and the twos, mm-hmm. mainly just the ones. He just can do the twos just occasionally if he needs a little extra push over the cliff.
Sure, sure.
Can I do a reading?
Yeah, please.
This is just, I love this. The first line in this article from How Stuff Works by the very talented Candace Gibson goes as such. I just think this is perfect. Quaker-born Charles Mallory Hatfield, tidy in appearance and straightforward with a salesman's bearing and a farm boy's self-assuredness, made an eyebrow-raising offer to the desperate city council of San Diego in 1915.
And this is where our story begins. Let's give you a little bit of background about Charles Mallory Hatfield. Charles Mallory Hatfield was what he preferred to call a moisture accelerator, a pluviculturist. To the average person at the time, that meant he was a rainmaker, or we should say he was a self-proclaimed rainmaker. And San Diego at the time was in a really tough, arid spot.
Yes, they were in desperate need of rain to help refill the city's dwindling marina reservoir. So this meeting, as described by Candace Gibson, took place in which Charles Mallory Hatfield offered up his services to do just that, refill the city's reservoir. Mallory's fee? $10,000. $10,000. Seems low for the magical gift of rain, but back in those days, it equated to around $230,000, and he would receive payment upon delivery of services.
Right, because they were understandably skeptical, and the question would be, well, what's to stop us from giving you $10,000 and then just learning that you skipped town? And he said, pay on delivery. So that's, I think, that's what really convinced them.
Total power move too, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. So they accepted his offer. However, they accepted it verbally. It was a smile and a handshake. And no one signed anything on paper guaranteeing Mallory this 10 large. But he went about his business nonetheless.
Yeah, and apparently he had, to his estimation, perfected a particular formula of cloud seeding through 17 other contracts with other known commercial organizations ranging from cotton growers in Texas to mine operators in Alaska. And what he developed was this technique. Like I said, it was an early form of cloud seeding. Now, this wasn't the stuff of Kate Bush songs chronicling the eccentric pseudoscience of Wilhelm Reich's attempts to harness the weather using orgone energy. You know, any Kate mm-hmm. Bush fans in the house?
Well, I was thinking
Casey's nodding.
Wilhelm Reich.
Wilhelm Reich fans too. It's cloud busting, mm-hmm. daddy.
Yeah.
But no, it's not that. This is much more, there's a touch more actual science involved here. As Lauren Ricketts, a broadcast meteorologist with NBC4 in Washington, D.C. puts it, cloud seeding is a form of weather modification in which we can enhance precipitation development by using certain chemicals to create an environment within clouds that is conducive to forming precipitation.
Right, accelerating moisture almost. And this sounds like it's a little pseudoscience-y, right? But it turns out that there have been multiple experiments with the concept of affecting the weather, and specifically affecting clouds, through the use of substances like silver iodide or potassium iodide and dry ice. Mallory, 17 times before he had spoken with San Diego, had attempted to do something like this, and he stood by his results. He had a cloud-gathering formula that was comprised of 23 substances. At this point, the exact ratios or the identity of those substances is unfortunately lost to history. He took it to his grave, by all accounts. Whenever I hear somebody talking about secret ingredients, I always think of the current trade secret ingredients, like how Coca-Cola has a secret recipe. and the three people who know it are not allowed to be on an airplane at the same time.
Right, or like maybe only one person carries a piece of the ingredient.
And, yeah.
You know, you have to have all three of them in a room at the same time, and they also have to turn secret keys simultaneously.
Yeah.
We watched too many movies. Yeah, but this guy, Mallory, he built this giant tower, right? It's like a wooden tower that he used to ionize the atmosphere, and I had a hard time finding details about, like, did he pump it up? Did he shoot it into?
Oh, yeah.
What did he do?
Check this out. Okay, so he builds this 20-foot tower, and it's in the woods east of town.
Okay.
And one city official – this is my favorite part, and this is the least proven part of this whole shenanigan. One city official said that Mallory recited an incantation aimed at wringing moisture from the air.
What?
Yeah.
I didn't catch that detail.
Yeah.
Well, that's amazing.
That's also – it's – you know, hearsay from a city official, and we'll learn why they may not be the most objective witnesses in the story. We know that he put these troughs on top of the tower, and that's where he put his mixture. Like, he poured it into these troughs and ignited it, creating smoke.
There we go.
That drifted upwards into the
sky. I was missing the delivery mechanism. Have we talked about the makeup of what they think his concoction might have been?
Well, we've just mentioned some of the operative ingredients in cloud seeding, but we haven't made any guesses about this. Do you think there was maybe gunpowder?
Yeah,
there
was.
In there?
Yeah, that was speculated that it was gunpowder and maybe hydrogen. But whatever was in it, apparently the concoction, it worked like a lot, like a lot.
Yes. Whether by miracle or measurable quantitative science, it rained. It poured. It was a biblical deluge. It occurred a few days
after. They were likely old men that snored.
Right. Yeah. it occurred just a few days after Hatfield began his process. It was in January and early February of 1916 that 30 inches, an estimated 30 inches of rain fell. And Mission Valley flooded. The San Diego River overflowed. Entire farms and homes and bridges and businesses were swept away.
Can you picture the city council just watching this from their offices and at first being like high-fiving each other and then just gradually the realization setting in? It's like, what have we done? Mm-hmm. And I just picture Mallory rubbing his hands together in a Mr. Burns kind of fashion, doing like an evil villain.
Like, is he a real-life weather modification supervillain, or is he kind of like the Mickey Mouse wizard in Fantasia who makes the, you know, animates that one mop?
You know, I like that a lot. I think I prefer to think of him as the creepy guy watching from afar as the chaos that he has unleashed devours the city. Maybe he had a big grudge against the city council of San Diego.
Oh, yeah.
Who knows?
Maybe his, like, high school sweetheart broke up with him and lived in San Diego. That's all pure speculation. I don't want people to be villains, so.
Well, whatever his motivations, yeah. Telephone lines snapped and washed away. The roads and railroad tracks cracked under the pressure of all of this water. But this was just the beginning, right? There's more. It continued to just beat the hell out of drought-parched county, which was, I think, maxed out at around 30 inches by the end of January. Mm-hmm. And the reservoir, you know, it was mission accomplished. The reservoir was full, but the lower Otay Reservoir couldn't contain all of this water, and the dam broke, and the waters killed nearby residents. Estimates put that number at around between a dozen to 50 deaths, and farm animals and homes were destroyed. I mean, you know.
Yeah, there was a real and genuine loss of life, unfortunately. This quickly becomes obviously a disaster, but Mallory, and you have to wonder how he broached this topic of conversation.
So about that money.
Yeah, so Mallory walks up to city council and says, "Well, I think my work here is done." And they're saying, you know, people are dying. They're probably still like soaking wet themselves.
That's what I'm saying. The city council people probably just looked at him with like just dead eyes. Just like, you know, you got some nerve turning up here, buddy.
So ordinarily a lot of rain, right? If you're just guessing, it's understandable how we could think a lot of rain is good for a drought-stricken area. But the problem that occurs is that when there is a drought and the soil itself is very dry, it won't be able to absorb the rain.
Exactly.
And so this means that instead of going into the ground, it's going across the ground. And that's how those buildings end up washing away when the valley floods and the dams are broken. And this, you know, leads to the loss of human life. Without knowing the specifics of their conversation, it's fairly safe to say that the city council members said, "What the hell are you thinking, you monster? No, we're not giving you $10,000. And they thought that if they paid Hatfield money for this, first off, they'd be ridden out of office on a rail.
Right.
At minimum.
Well, they'd look like they co-signed the whole thing and they were complicit and they essentially paid a dude to like destroy their town.
Yeah. Which would probably go on their permanent council member record.
That's going on your permanent record.
The time you tried to drown the city that like appointed you. Yeah. So Hatfield notices that people are infuriated and looking for someone to blame, right? And he ditches town. He lights out for the territories on his own, and then he waits for the waters to settle, for the water level to decrease. And after the water level decreases, get this, he tries to take San Diego to court. And he says, "I did what I said I would do. I should be paid for my services." And this court case goes on. It goes on for a year. It goes on for 5 years. It goes on for 20 years. Mm. Eventually, it's dismissed, and he never got a dime.
Poor guy?
It's tough to call. It's a tough call to make.
Yeah, like I said, I'm still kind of picturing him cackling, you know, in his secret underground lair.
Here's the weird part, though. It's even more complicated when we think that, well, did he ruin his life because he underestimated the impact of his secret concoction, right?
Well, and also, but like when I first saw this article, I was like, is that a thing? Is weather control? I thought we couldn't control the weather.
It is absolutely a thing, but it is not by any means a precise science.
I think that's where my brain kind of like hit a wall with this. Okay. So he had some stones, right? Mm-hmm. He came back to the city council and said, "Hey, where is my check?" Mm-hmm. And they laughed him out of the room. Court case drug on. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, he got nothing. But he wasn't like lacking for work. I mean, it's kind of a big deal, even though the city council didn't pay him or necessarily openly co-sign his activities. Everyone knew that he was what he was doing. I mean, it was like, you know, kind of an odd thing to have happen. And I think it certainly mm-hmm. turned some heads, right? And so his reputation got around, and nations like Canada, Cuba, and even Honduras sought him out for his, you know, supposed expertise. Mm-hmm. And so this, you know, catastrophe ultimately made a name for him and kind of boosted his career, though his usefulness kind of dwindled as water storage technology became more of a thing.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, I didn't consider that, because as we learn more about how to reuse, store and collect water, maybe we don't need so many rainmakers in the world. But circumstances suggest that Hatfield probably made an error and probably wasn't taking in the drought's effect on the land and soil. He was probably so fixated on proving that his technology worked mm-hmm. that he didn't think about the ramifications of his actions.
So that's what I'm saying. Like, you really think it was – he totally made this happen, like 100%. No question.
Yeah, I think no question. Furthermore, I would go on to say that Hatfield's work paved the way for cloud seeding technology. But do you think we should explore a little bit of his successors in this field?
Absolutely. Like I said, this is all kind of like – really fascinating to me, and before looking into this story, I really did not think this was something that was achievable by humans.
So there's a lot of debate about this stuff, not just in Hatfield's time, but in the modern day and several decades before. Going back to the meteorologist we mentioned earlier, Ricketts says that clouds that are seeded are getting about a 5 to 20% increase in precipitation. So their precipitation potential is being enhanced, not necessarily magnified. You know, it's not going to be a 100% sure thing. But modern governments are using this technology. China creates about 55 billion tons of what they would call artificial rain per year, and it costs about $168 million per year to do this, or 1.5 billion yuan as of January 2017. We can use, we being the human species, or I guess technically also you, Casey, and myself, we can use cloud seeding technology to influence the weather. But without being a meteorologist, I'm just reminded of every sci-fi horror movie where somebody pipes up and says, "You're meddling with things you cannot possibly comprehend. The world's weather system is so complex and interconnected that I feel like if you influence something in one area, you're inevitably influencing things in the other parts of the world." China famously used cloud seeding technology in the 2008 Olympics.
Yeah, I really do need to look into more of this stuff because I just was so mystified. And apparently, it's just totally a thing and everybody knows about it except little me.
No, I don't think a lot of people know about it because it sounds like science fiction.
That's, I think, what it is. And the fact that there is sort of like a gray area in like how do we get specific results or just like in the case of this story, completely jack everything all to hell.
The U.S. also is attempting cloud seeding, and still in California. In 2009 in Sacramento, California, some people had set up a tall metal platform with a crude furnace and silver iodide solution that scientists were hoping would provide relief from a drought. And we can only hope that they had more reasonable results there. But according to Arlen Huggins, who is a research scientist at the Desert Research Institute in Reno, what's going on in the U.S. concerning this sort of stuff is tiny in comparison. The Chinese government has been working with cloud seeding technology since 1958 when it was given to them via the Russian government.
That's fascinating.
It's fascinating, but it's also kind of scary, you know. We also have experiments done by the U.S., in foreign countries with weather modification.
Do you think this could be potentially like used as a weapon?
Absolutely. Yeah, or attempted to. Right now, I don't – the thing about a weapon is you would want it to be able to be targeted.
Yeah, is it like that movie Geostorm that's coming out?
Is Geostorm about that?
Well, it's just about like a satellite that shoots a laser beam and makes the weather all crazy and, you know, turns – you know, like California into the ice age, and it looks terrible, but, you know, kind of fun.
Yeah. Is it, are you going to see it?
I don't really go out for the big, you know,
the big blockbusters.
Yeah. Well, especially like the disaster movies. It just doesn't seem like fun to me. Although I really enjoyed Independence Day when I was a kid.
Here, maybe this is a good place for us to wrap up. This is something I didn't know about. And when you talked about, when you asked whether weather modification, there we go, could be used as a weapon. I thought, no, you know, that's ridiculous. But the U.S. government did not. During 1967 through 1972, they had a weather modification program in Southeast Asia called Operation Popeye. This was during the Vietnam War, and they were attempting to extend the monsoon season over areas of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and they were hoping that this would support the efforts of the U.S. government in the area. Their objectives were to soften road surfaces, cause landslides along roadways, wash out river crossings, and keep the soil saturated beyond the natural time span. Their slogan that the 54th Weather Reconnaissance Squadron used was "Make mud, not war." It's not as solid as that Still Yagi one from earlier.
Oh, man. Make mud, not war. I think there is not a better place to wrap up than with that quote.
However, we do have one more surprise. I'm very happy to be with you here today, man, because this is a little bit of a milestone for us.
Me?
Yeah, you. Specifically you.
Oh, man, I'm happy to be here with you too, buddy.
We're doing our first listener mail.
And our first of two listener mails we received at the inbox, ridiculous@howstuffworks.com. We've got one coming from Zachary. He says, Noel and Ben, my favorite thing that has been repeated in history is the crazy amount of times people have tried and failed to invade via the Bok Dong River in Vietnam. In 938, China failed to invade, and then in 1288, they tried and failed again. Both times, they were easily beaten by Vietnamese forces, placing spikes in the river during low tide, and then watching Chinese forces getting destroyed. Why am I laughing? This sounds horrendous, but it's pretty smart and pretty ridiculous. Watching Chinese forces getting destroyed and then tried coming through in high tide. As for my favorite Chinese food, it's probably the amazing potato, beef, and rice dish I had when I studied abroad in Xi'an, China. But I'm also a huge fan of orange chicken. Love the show, Zach. I think orange chicken was my pick. I think I said mall orange chicken, but I'm also all about more traditional dishes like the amazing potato, beef, and rice dish mentioned here in this email. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for writing in, dude.
Yeah, thanks so much, Zach. When I first brought up orange chicken, I was just sort of I was just sort of picturing what would be on almost every Chinese menu in the U.S. at least.
Sure.
And then, and when you pointed out mall orange chicken, it inspired me. I got really close to grabbing some recently, but I was way late in New York, so I had some awesome hand-pulled noodles.
Did you go to Xi'an's Famous Foods?
No.
Have you heard of
this
it?
Trip. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, I've been there before.
Listeners, if you're ever in New York, if you live in New York, Xi'an's Famous Foods, they have these – the reason I brought it up, Ben, is the hand-pulled noodles. Mm-hmm. It is literally like in a bowl. It's like a single noodle. But
it's insane.
But it incorporates into this whole bowl of food, and they do like one with ground lamb and the spices. It's just like it's Szechuan, I think, but it's like got kind of a different.
It's almost got
Indian quality to it.
Yeah, it's got almost a, I would want to say, Western region of the continent.
Right? Absolutely right. That's totally what it is, Ben.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Zach, and I would love to hear more about your time studying abroad. In the meantime, we have a second listener mail from our friend Tom W., who says, Ben, Noel, hello from the sunny city of Berlin, Germany. I just found your podcast, Ridiculous History, really enjoyed it. Thank you. He says he's going to put it on his favorite list. He has a comment on the subject of butter tax and Germany as follows. I'm retired here, says Tom, in Berlin, and there are certain sayings I have experienced in German which I find very interesting. There's one saying that goes, Es ist alles in Butter, and it translates to, it's all in butter. I know it means it's all taken care of, but during Martin Luther's days, butter was transported in barrels, and to avoid paying the full tax on the butter, porcelain was pushed into the butter when it was stopped for inspection. The explanation for the butter was that it was packing material for safe transport of the porcelain. So it's like, oh, you can't tax the butter. It's essentially like a styrofoam peanut thing. Speaking of the butter tax, says Tom, there are also some other strange food tricks. For example, on meatless days, the church reclassified the beaver as a fish because the beaver swam. Therefore, beaver could also be eaten on meatless days with a clear conscience. People who had meat to eat started cooking meat on meatless days by wrapping the meat in dough. I believe they thought God could not see what was inside the dough, and this, says Tom, is how ravioli came about being popular.
And Tom gets the prize for most uses of the word meat in a single sentence.
Yes. And Tom says, one final thing. The monks dug thousands of ponds throughout Europe in order to raise carp to be sold to the people. These ponds still exist today. All the best, Tom. Thank you so much for writing in, Tom. I think I am going to launch It's All in Butter as a catchphrase here in English and see how it goes. Wish me luck.
You know what I say, Ben? Don't tell me not to live. Just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my ridiculous history parade.
And this concludes our listener mail.
But as my good friend Ben would say, but not our show, because we haven't been canceled yet. We're new. It's a new show. I think we're doing well. Thank you guys for listening and writing in and not being too overly pedantic. I think we've only gotten one punchable email. But no, just the one. Just the one. Everything else. Everyone else has been lovely. And, you know, you guys, if you like the show, do us a solid. Go to iTunes and write a review. Give us, like, all the stars and, you know, say that we're engaging and enjoyable to listen to.
Or
whatever.
Tell your friends we were good at jokes one time.
The one time.
Yeah, we might get there one day. And in the meantime, while you're online, you can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram, where you'll see all sorts of other equally ridiculous tidbits about human civilization.
You can find our latest pony-themed vision board on Pinterest. Not really.
You can find our latest reenactment of Martin Luther's 95 Theses on Foursquare. Is that a thing still?
Foursquare is that like a Yelp kind of thing?
It was one of those
check-in?
Yeah, services that just had you check in. Which
never got what that was about.
That drove me crazy. Mm-hmm. Do I just essentially want to tell every criminal on the planet that I'm not at my house? Mm-hmm.
Ben still has a live journal active. He's one of the only remaining users, so you can check him out there. Or you can just write us an email at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com, and, you know, maybe we'll read your email on the show.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you still have any MySpace or Friendster pages up?
I got a MySpace page.
What do you think about the idea of weather modification or cloud seeding or so-called rainmakers? If you had any experience with this, you can contact us via all the social media my partner Noel here just named, or you can write to us directly at ridiculous@howstuffworks.com.
And most importantly, we really look forward to joining you again for the next episode of Ridiculous History. See you there.